From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, America's snow day in much of the country. Then Ron Elving on the Week in Politics. Later, the U.N. declares yodeling part of the world's intangible cultural heritage. But intangible doesn't mean unheard. As Swiss scholar Nadja Ross says,
we change very fast between the head voice and the chest voice.
And later a new novel on a canoodling couple who were caught in their hotel room when terrorists strike, Room 706. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, January 24, 2026.
KAXC News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. Lead pipes in public water systems are common throughout Minnesota and the country. So Hibbing Public Utilities' recent discovery of elevated lead in some samples isn't all that unique, but HPU's response is. Minnesota water providers are required to sample inside 30 homes each year. In Hibbing, six had lead levels above what the Environmental Protection Agency calls the lead action level. Here's Paul Plombon, HPU's energy and operations manager.
The limit for lead is 15 parts per billion. We had some that were just above that, some upwards of close to 60.
There's no safe level of lead exposure for anyone.
Anna Schleep is the Minnesota Department of Health's lead and drinking water coordinator.
We know that it can cause impacts to learning, development, behavior, hearing problems, things like that. The biggest exposure to lead is still from lead paint and lead dust. But drinking water is something that lots of people use.
Hibbing Public Utilities could have simply sent out a notice about the lead levels, done a bit of education, and addressed the issue at the homes it knew had too much lead. But instead, they chose to be aggressive. Those elevated levels came back in October. Before the ground froze, they dug about 500 potholes. That means blasting down to look at water lines on both the utility side and the customer side.
If you're not familiar with it, there's a line coming, water line coming from the house all the way out to the curb stop, and which is the shutoff for the house. And then there's usually a smaller section, depending on where the water main is, that is utility owned, and that goes out to the main.
Before that, HPU knew about 8 or 9 lead lines. The potholing upped that count to about 90. Service lines are the main way that lead gets into water in Minnesota. Lead solder and fixtures are big sources, too. That means even homes with well water can still have lead. Anytime water sits, lead can leach in. Concerns around lead poisoning really started to grow in the 70s. New lead plumbing was banned in 1986. The health department's speech says there's been a lot of work to lower lead exposure in those decades. For a long time, the focus was on corrosion control to minimize lead in water. In 2021, the EPA changed its lead and copper rules, adding requirements to identify and replace lead service lines. Minnesota's goal is to replace all these lines by 2033.
But our general manager is confident we can do ours in 2 to 3 years.
Most Minnesota water systems, including Hibbing, are still in the identification phase. That's evident when you look at the state's online map of lead service line inventories. There, you can check each water system to see how many lines are lead. Hibbing has about 6,000 service lines. The type of about one-third are still unknown. Customers are often hesitant to let people into their homes, but HPU has been more aggressive about that, too. In the last week, they've looked at some 150 lines. It's a slow process, but getting inside homes to help identify those lines is a big focus this winter.
This customer side, being able to complete this is a really high priority because that will help inform the rest of our potholing projects.
Elliot Dixon is HPU's engagement specialist.
And so they feed into each other to make sure that we're making the best decisions we can, putting the funding in the most effective place possible for these upcoming replacement projects as well.
The cost of the work is prohibitive for a lot of communities. The state provides some funding, but that's part of the reason behind Hibbing's aggressive approach. More data to back up the need for additional money means they could get more to help pay for replacements.
If you want to look at it like this, Hibbing is more standing up for the little guy. And if we have to be the voice of reason and be down at the state capitol and in Washington, D.C., talking about this, spreading the word of what we're doing, helping other communities if we can. And even if it helps just by being down there and being the squeaky wheel and saying they're not going to go away until we give them something and help them out, then we're okay with that.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Over 200 million Americans are in for a weekend of tough weather. A powerful and dangerous winter storm is expected to hit a massive portion of the country across New Mexico, Texas, and the plains, over the Deep South and into the Northeast. Some areas expect more than a foot of snow, freezing rain, sleet, and worst of all, ice. Thousands of flights have already been canceled, more expected. NPR's Frank Morris is hunkered down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Frank, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, Scott.
And storm's already, is just getting started, but it's already having an enormous effect, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The storm is mostly shutting down a huge swath of the nation this weekend. Even though it's only Saturday, school districts from El Paso, Texas, to Philadelphia, some 2,000 miles away, have already canceled classes into next week. Roads, of course, are going to be slick for days. The storm has already knocked tens of thousands of homes and businesses off the power grid, mainly in Texas. It's expected to trigger widespread outages from central Texas, fanning out through the Carolinas and into Virginia. And some of those blackouts could last a week or more. And the storm threatens to drop more than a foot of snow from Oklahoma City to New York City. Then there's the bitter cold. We're expecting lows in the single digits Monday in Tulsa.
Where you are, what are people doing there to prepare?
You know, they're doing pretty much the same as, like, 200 million other people facing bad roads and power outages this weekend. They're stocking up on supplies. At Oasis Fresh Market, a grocery store in North Tulsa, Shavonda Pinnell, Jacob Washburn, and Ty Walker filled their shopping carts. Let's take a listen.
I've already been out to the store once, but I went and came back and got some more meats, water, toiletries, just all the necessities. I'm only hoping 2 days.
Yep, stocking up. Walmart, we had an online order and they canceled it on us. Ordered it 2 days ago and they canceled it, so here I am.
I got potatoes and I got some beans and they're going to stick to you.
Yeah, despite the cold and hassle, lots of people here say they're looking forward to being hunkered down with their families for a while.
Well, cozy as that sounds, it's also a dangerous situation too, isn't it? What people face?
Oh, yeah. Right. You know, Scott, ice is the main concern. It's building up on power lines right now, and eventually they snap, or trees take them down. And when they go, the power goes with them. Widespread outages are expected to fan out over nearly 2,000 miles. And power crews will take days, if not weeks, to restore electricity. And without electricity, many people's furnaces won't work. Fumes from generators kill people in every big winter storm. Emergency officials say caution not to use a generator indoors or in the garage. When it's outside, make sure it's not near any windows. Inside, space heaters and candles can spark fires.
What about roads?
Boy, the roads are going to be dangerous for days. Across many states, the roads are being pre-treated, but this much snow and ice is going to make many impassable. The operations manager for the Public Works Department here in Tulsa told me that the last time there was a snowstorm this bad 15 years ago, it took 2 weeks to get all the streets clear. Another storm people remember here, an ice storm in 2007, cut power to North Tulsa for a week. And one woman here told me she's never seen Tulsa look so bad.
Well,
so clearly the best message.
Yeah, well, the best message is people stay off the streets. NPR's Frank Morris
right.
in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
You bet, Scott. Thank you.
Relatively balmy, cloudy with a high in the 40s today in Nuuk, the capital of Greenland. And talk of Greenland is where we begin with NPR senior contributor Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to chill out with you, Scott.
At the World Economic Forum in Davos this week, President Trump said he'd reached a framework for a deal on Greenland. What kind of deal seems to be at hand after weeks of threats of military action and tariffs and musing about buying Greenland?
We don't have all the details yet, and there's a good deal yet to be learned and assessed for significance. The U.S. looks to have more military presence beyond the Pituffik base. It used to be called Thule. We have that in Greenland. And it's been part of the distant early warning system for generations now, but we also expect to see more mining of strategic materials, such as the rare earths, essential to computers and other high-tech products. The deal would bolster the presence of NATO in general in the Arctic and restrict Russian and Chinese efforts to get mining rights for those rare earths in Greenland. Those two items speak to the fears expressed in a lot of President Trump's rhetoric when he was talking about seizing the territory by force.
Ron, I want to be careful about raising this, but I think it's important to ask you. President Trump rambled a lot in his remarks at Davos. He referred to Greenland as Iceland several times. He mocked the sacrifices, lives lost of U.S. allies, and seemed not to know that, in fact, NATO had come to the defense of the United States after 9/11. President Biden had a shaky debate performance. There were calls from both parties for him to step down. Has President Trump's conduct made his mental health a genuine concern?
One big difference between this moment and the Biden debate is that Trump is not on the ballot in November, the way Biden was. But hundreds of other Republicans are. As candidates for Congress and state offices, the Biden example is not lost on those campaigns. Trump will be 80 in June. People notice changes in his walk and his talk and changes on his face and his hands. Then they start noticing behavior. And noticing when he loses his temper repeatedly over small things, or when he says adverse polls in the New York Times are fake and fraudulent and should be treated as a criminal offense, or when he goes on sending social media messages well into the wee hours. This kind of change in a president was not discussed publicly in the past, but in the wide open ethos of 21st century social media, Scott, nothing seems out of bounds. So we have to begin seeing mentions, at least, of the 25th Amendment, which was enacted 60 years ago to set a formal procedure in situations that might arise if the president were incapacitated. It's only been used in temporary situations up to now, such as the president undergoing surgery.
Canada's Prime Minister Carney had strong words for the president in Davos. Brussels Thursday, President Macron of France urged his fellow EU leaders to implement economic anti-coercion measures against the U.S., referred to as a trade bazooka. EU did not agree, but Germany also expressed interest. What does this tell us about the state of the U.S. among those nations usually considered its staunchest allies?
It says that no matter how politely people may smile and applaud in the audience, they do have ears and egos. World leaders, such as we saw at Davos, have national pride and personal pride, just as we do, and they don't appreciate being treated as junior partners or ungrateful children.
House Oversight Committee voted to hold Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton in contempt for refusing to comply with subpoenas in their investigation of Jeffrey Epstein. Lawyers for the Clintons say they have communicated voluntarily with the committee, but that the subpoenas are a ploy to attempt to embarrass political rivals. Where does this go now?
Two senior advisors from Trump's first term went to jail rather than cooperate with Congress. I doubt anyone expects the Clinton case to go that route, but one unintended consequence could happen. It may keep the Epstein saga in the news at a time when it might have been losing some steam.
NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you, Scott.
Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney opened his remarks in Davos by citing an essay by Václav Havel, the Czech playwright, dissident, and eventually president. When The Power of the Powerless was written in 1978, Havel's country was still in the grip of Soviet communist control. The essay could only be circulated by hand and read in secret. It was eventually published around the world. Havel's essay invites us to ask ourselves, how can good people sign on to the nonsense of a bad regime? Havel presents a greengrocer who puts a sign at his window saying, "Workers of the World Unite," an old communist rallying cry. Why does he do it, asks Havel? He could be reproached for not having the proper decoration in his window. Someone might even accuse him of disloyalty. He does it because these things must be done if one is to get along in life. And Havel asks, who would say it's wrong for workers of the world to unite? It's an excuse that everyone can use, he writes, from the greengrocer who conceals his fear of losing his job behind an alleged interest in the unification of the workers of the world, to the highest functionary whose interest in staying in power can be cloaked in phrases about his service to the working class. Havel's essay did not call for mass demonstrations, although many would follow. It suggested that change might begin in a society when people stop the rote motions by which a government infers loyalty. Prime Minister Carney did not mention President Trump by name, but he called on what he called middle powers, like Canada, most of the European states at Davos, to live the truth and see the scaffold of American power on which so much of their security had been built was being abandoned. When even one person stops performing, said the Prime Minister, when the green grocer removes his sign, the illusion begins to crack. Friends, it is time for companies and countries to take their signs down and find a different way forward. Almost half a century later, Václav Havel's vision and words may offer strength as the world faces another great change. And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXC. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Again, that's psa@kaxc.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota. Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. It is 7:19. I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, January 26 at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxc.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our board of directors are held the fourth Monday of the month, and you can find the board's meeting schedule at kaxc.org. Another cold day in northern Minnesota. Our highs today 5 below to 10 below, calm wind, and lows tonight 18 to 24 below zero. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 10 below to 1 above, and lows on Sunday night 19 to 24 below. Looking ahead to Monday, we're going to have slightly warmer temperatures with highs in the low single digits above zero.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Donald Trump's aggressive immigration enforcement policies expanded this week to a state with one of the smallest immigrant populations in the country, Maine. The Department of Homeland Security says it has arrested more than 100 people there since Tuesday. Art Snyder, immigration reporter with Maine Public, has been following the story. Art, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And how did Maine become an objective?
Maine is an unusual target, right? There are only about 50,000 immigrants in the whole state, and about half are already citizens. But rumors that something like this could come have been building for a couple weeks, really ever since President Donald Trump, some state-level Republicans, and right-wing media started trying to draw connections between the fraud scandal happening in Minnesota and Maine's Somali community, which is one of the largest outside of Minnesota. Trump has also sparred publicly with Maine's Democratic governor, Janet Mills. And of course, as we've seen with past ICE operations, they have also targeted states or cities with Democratic elected leaders.
And Ari, what have you learned about this operation so far?
Yeah, so this operation began on Tuesday, according to DHS. Over 100 people arrested so far, as you mentioned at the top. That's a huge increase in the pace of arrests compared to last year, as we've seen here in Maine. We don't know how many agents are involved, but the operation for now seems mostly focused on Maine's two largest cities. Those are Portland and Lewiston, and some nearby smaller cities and towns. Local elected officials here say this is not warranted. Here's Portland City Councilor Wes Pelletier.
No one asked the federal government to come here. This is one of the safest cities in the country.
DHS has dubbed this, quote, Operation Catch of the Day. That's an apparent reference to Maine's fishing economy. Some state officials have criticized that language, saying it sounds like agents are hunting people for sport. And as of now, it's unclear how long it's going to last.
Ari, who is being arrested so far, and what do officials say?
So as in other cities, DHS says it's arresting, quote, the worst of the worst, people with serious criminal records. But it's only publicly acknowledged four people, it says, have specifically been arrested during this operation that have criminal records. And so far, we've only been able to verify two of those four. Immigration lawyers, meanwhile, are telling me it's mostly people without criminal records who are being arrested, people who are also following legal immigration pathways, such as seeking asylum. Some of the strongest words have actually come from Sheriff Kevin Joyce of Cumberland County, which includes Portland. One of his corrections officers was arrested by ICE this week, and Joyce says the man had no criminal record and had legal authorization to work. He spoke with reporters the day after the arrest.
We're being told one story, which is totally different than what's occurring or what occurred last night.
A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson said the corrections officer had illegally crossed the southern border in 2019. Sheriff Joyce has said his office had every indication that the man was following legal immigration pathways. And Sheriff Joyce says he's got no problem with ICE arresting criminals, but he feels that this situation just is different.
And Ari, what's been the reaction from Mainers in places like Portland and Lewiston, where this has been occurring?
Yeah, so there have been several protests against ICE, more in the works, including some today, and we're keeping an eye on some potential planned counter-protests. In the Portland area, people have been tracking ICE, trying to document the arrests and, you know, blowing whistles, honking horns when they see agents. But that's been challenging to do in some cases because ICE seems to be moving quite quickly here. They seem to be going after one, two, maybe a few people at a time, making the arrest and leaving. There's not always a chance for observers to get on the scene in time to witness the arrest. Meanwhile, fears in the immigration community are just so widespread right now, growing reports of students skipping school, parents staying home from work. But one Congolese man I spoke with the other day says he can't stay home. He's got bills to pay, so he's still going to work even though he's anxious. Volunteers are trying to help. They're delivering food, walking kids to school, accompanying people to appointments, and raising money for rent because there's concern that breadwinners are being arrested or afraid to go to work.
Maine Public, Sari Snyder, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This week, the federal agency tasked with protecting workers from discrimination rolled back key guidance on harassment. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission voted 2-1 to rescind a nearly 200-page document explaining what exactly is illegal under federal law. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the catalyst for the move was a section about gender diversity.
A year ago, President Trump issued an executive order asserting that, quote, women are biologically female and men are biologically male. He talked about it the other day.
Two genders. This was not a tough one. Two genders. Can anybody guess what they are?
He directed federal agencies to revise or rescind documents that go beyond that view. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's 2024 harassment guidance made that list because of a section about trans people. But most of the document discusses harassment based on other protected characteristics.
Race, religion, disability, age, sex, of course.
That's Charlotte Burrows. She was chair of the EEOC when the guidance was approved. She says it has helped countless employers and EEOC staff members protect workers from harassment.
That's what the commission has decided to walk away from.
The current EEOC chair, Andrea Lucas, was a commissioner back in 2024, and she voted against the guidance, objecting to two examples of harassment it described. First, repeatedly and intentionally calling someone by a name or pronoun they no longer use. And second, denying someone access to a bathroom consistent with their gender identity. She wrote that it's not harassment to acknowledge that sex is binary. And she went on to say women in the workplace will pay the price. Now, as chair, Lucas has led the effort to get rid of the document entirely.
And I vote yes.
Without giving the public a chance to weigh in, as is the norm. At Thursday's vote, Lucas said rescinding the guidance would not leave a void where employers would be free to harass, leaving a trail of victims in their wake.
Let me be perfectly clear. The EEOC will not tolerate unlawful harassment, as was the case before the guidance document was issued and will remain so even after the guidance document is rescinded.
Now, the Trump administration acknowledges that you cannot fire someone because they're transgender. That was affirmed by the Supreme Court. But misgendering someone or denying them access to a bathroom, the administration says those are different matters. Lucas noted that last year, a federal court in Texas struck down the part of the guidance about gender identity.
We were sued, and a court vacated it in full.
And already last year, the EEOC dropped a number of discrimination lawsuits involving transgender workers. Before the vote, the lone Democratic commissioner, Kalpana Kodagal, described one of them, someone who worked on a hog farm.
Her employer permitted a coworker to expose his genitals to her and grope her intimate body parts without consent. She was repeatedly, intentionally deadnamed by leadership and endured explicit sexual comments and advances.
And eventually, she quit. Kodagal says it's not only transgender workers who will be harmed by the rollback of the guidance. Others will suffer too.
From employees being called racial slurs or epithets, to employees contending with anti-Semitic graffiti, or being harassed for being older, or for needing religious accommodations, or for contending with a disability.
Now, to be clear, federal anti-discrimination laws haven't changed, but the fear is that without official guidance explaining what is unlawful, harassment on the job will be harder to stop. Before the vote, civil rights groups held a rally outside EEOC headquarters in Washington, D.C. Maria Towne, president of the American Association of People with Disabilities, pointed out harassment charges based on disability are the most common.
This harassment guidance isn't just a necessary resource for disabled people. It is literally a tool that we must use to create economic opportunity and power.
Yes. She says rescinding it will hurt workers and employers both.
Workplaces where harassment is allowed to thrive are not workplaces at all.
Because she says they are not places where work can meaningfully get done. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Washington.
Next time you plug an address into an app for directions or tag a social media post with your location, please take a second to thank Gladys West. She was an African-American mathematician who helped to develop the algorithms that made GPS possible. Here's what she told the TV show TPI Zone in 2019.
What we did was got the accuracy of where things were located all around the world in a database.
Gladys West died last week at the age of 95. Marvin H. Jackson was a friend who co-authored her memoir, and he joins us now. Mr. Jackson, thanks so much for being with us, and we're sorry for your loss.
You're very welcome. Anytime I get to talk about Gladys West, it's an honor.
Well, help us understand the difference she's made in our lives.
Oh, she made such a big difference. The way we travel today couldn't be done without contributions that Dr. Gladys West made. You know, for me, she made a big difference in my life because Dr. West and my mom were born the same year. They both were in segregation in the South. They both finished first in their high school class. They both got scholarships to HBCUs. She was so much like my mom. We just became like family.
I gather Dr. West, born in 1930 in rural Virginia, but she dreamed of a different life than what her family had in agriculture. Let's put it that way, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She was a hard worker, but she wanted to do a different type of work where she would wear away from home clothes instead of home clothes. Home clothes were jeans and working in the farm. And she just dreamed that one day she would do that. And it's such an inspiring story because there are a lot of Black girls, especially back then and now even, who might have that same dream. And maybe they hear that and say, well, I can be like her. I always tell Gladys, whenever I would talk to her, I always say, you are the real greatest of all time. People always say it's somebody like Beyonce, but I say it's really you. You are the hero for our young girls.
Dr. West began to work at what's now the Naval Surface Warfare Center, Dahlgren in Virginia, only the second Black woman to do so. Did she ever talk to you about what it was like to work there during the time of segregation?
Yes, it was the beginning of African Americans working in professional ranks in the federal government. And she had never been around white people in an integrated situation in school or work or anywhere. And neither had the white people been in that situation with people like her. So she said it was just difficult for everyone. Her husband was the second Black person there.
This is Ira.
Mm-hmm, Ira. What a great person he was as well. They were able to help each other get through that whole situation.
Why were the accomplishments of Dr. Gladys West relatively unnoticed for so long?
It was a career basically for white men. People who got all the recognition was, of course, going to be the white men. She was just doing her job. You know, of course, she was taught to always be twice as good as her white male counterparts. And she said that's what she aim to do every day.
Do I get this right, Mr. Jackson, that despite her crucial role in developing GPS, she preferred to use paper maps when she drove?
Yes, she and her husband. She and her husband always told me that, and we laughed and joked about it, but she did. She said she was old school.
What kept her going through all that she saw in her life?
People who inspired her. People like her Grandma Plum, who lived to be 111. Grandma Plum was born right after Civil War. Her parents had been slaves, and she had seen a little bit of everything in life. Been called every kind of name, from colored to Negro to African-American. She had seen the invention of cars and airplanes and telephones to computers. She was always inspired by her calm way and just that dream, wanting to do something different. Kind of taking a road that no one else had taken in her neighborhood.
Marvin Jackson, remembering the life of his friend, the mathematician Gladys West, who died last week at the age of 95. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. She's the greatest person I've ever been around.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Been another volatile week for transatlantic relations. President Trump continues to proclaim that Greenland will be part of the United States one way or the other, despite the fact that it's part of the Kingdom of Denmark. Leaders in Denmark and Greenland say they want to work with the U.S. but will not negotiate on sovereignty. Danish civilians say they're feeling whiplash, as NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports.
At the University of Copenhagen, political science student Willis Welling tells me his studies have gone from the theoretical to the eerily practical as President Trump continues to push to acquire Greenland. He remembers that Trump floated the idea during his first term.
I think most people in Denmark were just laughing, saying, oh, yeah, well, he's not going to, and he doesn't even know that you cannot buy another country. That's not how it works.
But Trump is doubling down, maintaining the U.S. needs Greenland for national security, despite already having military access. This week, he vowed to impose tariffs on European allies until a deal for the U.S. to obtain Greenland was reached, and then changed his mind.
We've come to realize that he wants to buy Greenland, but he is also willing to threaten us, and he is also willing to take action.
His friend, law student William Bruce, puts Trump's quest this way.
That gives some imperialistic flashbacks, in my head at least.
He says he grew up learning about the close alliance between the U.S. and Denmark, and now sees it turned upside down.
It's in some ways our big brother. It's a nation that we've always looked up to, felt that it was someone we shared values with. So to see someone speak in a way where it at least feels like he's willing to throw away that cooperation, that is shocking.
Emma Firestone agrees.
There's a sense that we are collectively living through a tragedy.
She's originally from Boston and is raising a family here in Copenhagen with her Danish husband. She said despite the upheaval, Danes seem to draw a distinction between the U.S. government and Americans abroad.
Everyone is capable of recognizing that, you know, they are not Donald Trump, they are not their administration, and they don't represent them.
Mestre Stolsen is a Dane who went to high school in Iowa.
I mean, in Denmark, everyone's very polite and likes to follow the rules and stand in line. And, you know, the idea of international law is something that people just assume that would be respected. And it feels very far-fetched to even talk about friendly countries having these kinds of discussions.
He says Americans should understand that Danes have viewed the U.S. as a strong ally, but that's shifting.
Now, the conversation in Danish media and in the workplace and when you talk to people is very much about how, well, it's time for Europe to stand alone. And I think most Danes are ready to say, okay, we don't want to have to rely on the U.S. for anything, really, because it's just too unpredictable and it's got nothing to do with people. It's got everything to do with politics.
This week, European leaders themselves echoed the need to chart an independent course with less reliance on the United States. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Copenhagen.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:39. Good morning. Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, a mix of story and song. This weekend, a slant-wise look at the economy. Michael Goldberg flies first class. Simon Gretton describes his abundant life. And Annie Humphrey talks about the sharing economy. We'll also hear from local small business owners about what's important to them. And that is this morning at 9, or you can catch it tomorrow evening at 5. 10 o'clock this morning, Jen Buey, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. University of Minnesota Extension offers Fridays with a Forester, a free Zoom series beginning this Friday, January 30th at 9 a.m. Find a full list of dates and topics at z.umn.edu/Fridays2026. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition here on KAXE.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Some 200 million people in the U.S. are in the path of a major winter storm this weekend. Forecasters say the system will bring heavy snow, sleet, and freezing rain from the southern Rockies to New England through Monday. President Trump has revoked an invitation to Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney to join his Board of Peace. The decision follows Carney's criticism of U.S. foreign policy. Trump has also threatened new tariffs on Switzerland and urged Denmark to support U.S. control of Greenland. The U.S. military says it carried out a deadly strike on a vessel accused of drug trafficking in the eastern Pacific. Officials say it was the first such operation since a recent raid that captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, for 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. If a tree explodes in a forest and there's no one there to hear it, did it really explode? A social media post warning of this winter weather phenomenon went viral earlier this week as people across the country prepared for this big winter storm. Bill McNee, a forest health specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, joins us now from Oshkosh. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The trees don't really explode, do they?
That term of an exploding tree is kind of a sensationalized headline that gets a lot of attention. In reality, the more appropriate term would be cracking tree. When it gets cold enough, the sap inside a tree will actually freeze. Most of the time, it's a liquid that has all sorts of sugars and things dissolved inside it. When that sap reaches that critical freezing temperature, which is usually well below 32 degrees, it will expand. Just like water will expand when it freezes, the sap is mostly water and the sap expands. This puts tremendous pressure on the inside of the tree. And if the tree is physically unable to handle that pressure, it cracks. And that's how it reduces the pressure on the inside of the tree. This usually does not kill the tree, but it can be a safety hazard. So if these large cracks appear in trees that are around people or buildings or vehicles, an arborist should look at this tree and determine if it is a safety hazard.
What's the sound like?
As you can imagine, it takes a lot of pressure to cause wood to crack. So it would not be uncommon to hear a large cracking sound, a large popping sound that almost sounds like a gunshot, but it is actually the wood physically cracking.
Any kind of tree is more vulnerable than another.
Maple trees get most of the attention given how common they are and how susceptible they are to cracking. Most hardwood trees that lose their leaves in the winter will crack if it gets cold enough, and conifers such as pine trees or spruce trees can also crack as well. When the temperature gets down to about minus 20, that's when the sap freezes and you get this cracking occurring.
That's really cold, isn't it?
The upper Midwest gets these cold temperatures every few years, so trees are used to this. they handle it. They may have a physical deformation, but they probably will live through it.
Is there anything people can do to avoid their trees cracking?
Realistically, the most practical thing for a homeowner with a small tree to do is wrap the tree with tree wrap. It's sort of like painter's tape or duct tape that you wrap around the base of the tree up to the first set of lower branches. This can help provide some insulation and hopefully reduce the likelihood that that small tree is going to reach that critical temperature at which it cracks.
Bill McNee of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, we wish you and your colleagues and everyone in Wisconsin a good weekend. Thanks so much, sir.
Thank you for having me.
We all know yodeling, right? Alpine men and women singing across verdant valleys and snow-capped peaks, sometimes accompanied by a huge horn. And now, yodeling's been officially recognized by the United Nations as an intangible cultural heritage of humanity, according to UNESCO. One of the people that's helped that along is Nadja Ross. She's a professor of yodeling and the head of the folk music department at the CERN University of Applied Sciences and Arts in Switzerland. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
What does yodeling mean to Switzerland?
So yodeling is, I say often, it's like the fifth language of our country. We have four spoken languages and we have one singing language. It's yodeling.
And their regional variations?
There are some variations. So we know yodeling with text, but we have also, mostly we have yodel without text. And this yodel we call Naturjodel. And this kind of yodel works like dialects. So it depends on the region you grow up. So if you grew up in eastern part, it sounds very melancholic. When you grow up in middle part, center part of Switzerland, it's quite loud and sometimes also a little bit fast.
Is it entertainment, communications? What kind of language is it for the Swiss?
Actually, it can be both. So we do it on stages. We entertain with yodel, of course, but it's also to show your feelings. There are seven reasons how the yodel is founded. And one is also that we show the feelings with the yodel, but it's also that we can show the movements of the mountains, or you can use the yodel also for to call the cows, for example.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, that's how I'm afraid a lot of Americans know about it from the movies and cow calling. I don't want to put you on the spot, but can I hear a sad, melancholic yodel?
Yes, I can do that very, very well because my father grew up in that part and I learned it by my childhood. So it's, for example, tra-li-di-o-ri-ru. Tra-li-di-o-ri-ru. And go on like that.
Oh, that's very beautiful. Thank you.
Yes.
Can I hear a kind of happy yodel?
Yes, this one I learned from a very old woman, and because of that it's called, next to her, it's Betlis Jödeli. It could be also instrumental, it's like that. And further like that, yes.
Wow, that's amazing. Is yodeling difficult to learn? Must take a long time.
Actually, I think it's like sport. You have to practice it, but you can learn it. So it's very important that you have a good breathing technique, mm-hmm. but you should be also able to choose your register of your voice. So we change very fast between the head voice and the chest voice. This is very typical for Swiss yodeling. And these are things you can practice. There are muscles you have to train.
So there's a head voice and there's a chest voice, right?
Yes. Do you know what it is?
Well, I guess, I mean, this is a head voice and this is a chest voice.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Well,
very good. Okay. Very good. When we sing the head voice, we use the vowel oo, for example. Yeah. Can you repeat?
No, but I'll try.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. It's difficult for men, yes. And in chest voice we use O. Yo-lo-lo-lo-lo.
Yo-lo-lo-lo-lo.
Yes, yes, very good. When you do the yodel, you have to change between them. Yeah. Yo.
Yeah.
It takes a little bit of time. Yes, yes.
Nadia, I don't want to alarm you, but I'm looking out of the window of our studio and I see a bunch of cows coming down the street. Is this?
It could be, yes. Actually, when you are in the region, they react on it, yes.
What does it mean to have yodeling recognized as a cultural heritage?
For me, it's very important for us in Switzerland that we go on, that we take care on the yodel, and then that we give it to the future, that we give it to the children's. And it's a present on the one side, and it gives us also a lot of work, but I like this work.
May I tell you? Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Oh, I feel so honored, Nadia Ross, Professor. And Yodler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kate Bright loves her husband, Vic, and their two children. She's also enjoying the latest installment of a long-standing assignation she has with her married lover, James, when the news begins to buzz, the very hotel in which they are ensconced in room 706 has been taken over by gunmen. And that's the setup for Ellie Levinson's new novel, Room 706. She's a journalist who's written for The Guardian and Cosmopolitan UK and joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Help us understand what brings Kate to room 706.
Well, in the book, it's termed a kind of me time. Kate justifies her affair by thinking it could be a secret drink after work by herself, or a facial, or maybe a kind of habit buying shoes or something like that. It's purely an escape from her everyday life.
Hmm. And does this crisis, this sudden crisis, cause her to review her life and who and what's truly important in it?
That's right. So she's stuck in the hotel room. She doesn't know how long she's going to have in there, or indeed if she's going to live or die. So she starts to kind of think through her life, the kind of idea that maybe life flashes before your eyes when you're going to die, except it doesn't so much flash because she's got a lot of time, so it goes quite slowly.
Yeah. Why tell a modern story of what it is to be a woman and a mother through the lens of this extraordinary incident?
Well, I think that Kate is a complicated woman, and I like that. I like reading about people who are neither all good or all bad. And I wanted to write something for modern women and men, but probably mostly women, who can handle complicated characters, whose own lives are complicated, and who will kind of have something to think about and ponder and discuss with their friends.
I must say, without giving away too much, it's almost more terrifying that we never really meet the terrorists. And then it occurred to me, well, Alan Rickman's gone, so, I mean, what can you do?
Well, I'm so pleased you mentioned him, because I feel Die Hard is a very big influence on this book. And I watched it again at Christmas time and realised just how much of an influence it has been on me, even though the book is very different. But it was deliberate that you don't meet the terrorists, because perhaps everybody's idea of a terrorist is different, and the causes and the reasons for terrorism change. So kind of the things that I was scared of encountering when I was a teenager are different to those that I now worry about for my own teenagers. And so it's really a vehicle to put Kate and James in the room and to show how little control people have over events.
I enjoyed reading the text messages that she sends to Vic, which are filled with love, but also very practical instructions, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a really funny mix, isn't it, of kind of thinking this might be my last chance to tell my husband that I love him, but also I need to make sure he has kind of the passwords for all the supermarket shop or the car insurance, that kind of thing.
Does James, the dashing lover, wilt a little in her eyes during this period in room 706?
Yeah, I think as Kate gets to know him, not as a lover, but as a person, and they have kind of conversations for the first time since they met, she realizes that he's just like anyone else. You know, he can be annoying, irritating, maybe the grass isn't greener. But then she wasn't looking for an alternative husband. It was something different to that.
I say this as a father. I really liked Vic.
Lots of people say that. I like him too. I like all of them in their own way. But maybe he's a little bit too nice at times. I mean, you know, you want to marry someone nice. Of course you do. But And this isn't me. This is my character. Of course, it's fiction. Yeah. But maybe she, maybe Kate finds her husband sometimes maybe a little bit too accommodating.
Mm. Our editor saw you give a talk to student journalists on feature writing and says you gave a very confident talk about how those ideas and inspiration can abound. Does that translate into writing this, your debut novel?
What a lovely thing to hear. I'm so pleased it had an impact. Yes, I think it does, because although, of course, in journalism, you're seeking to find the truth, and in fiction, you're doing kind of the opposite of that. You're making things up as you go. It gives you a way of thinking to explore ideas to the full. And I often felt, when I was thinking about the idea for this novel, that I wanted to take the kind of feature you might have in a magazine about, you know, how to make your lover leave their partner, or how do you know if your partner is having an affair, and turn it on its head. So it made me think about characters who don't want their lover to leave their partner, or don't want their affair to become something more.
Words invoked a couple of times at the end of the novel. Sonder. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, so Sonder I first saw as a meme from a kind of public art project, really, and it was called the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, and it was a website where John Koenig came up with words that he thought should exist in English but that don't exist. And Sonder really struck me. It's the idea that everybody else's life is as complex as yours, and so that you are just kind of an extra in their life as they are in yours. If you sit next to somebody on the bus or walk past somebody in a restaurant, and that, I guess, it's the idea that your life isn't more important or more complicated than anyone else's. And I thought that was really, really interesting. It really stuck with me, because in the hotel in which Kate and James are, every other room could have an equally complicated story. We just don't know it.
Your novel does remind us we have very limited influence as to how we'll be remembered by our loved ones.
That's true, but I was really influenced in many ways by the notes that people left on 9/11, when they, particularly the people in the airplane that crashed in Pennsylvania, and when people knew they were going to die and they wrote notes to their loved ones if they had time, it all boiled down to I love you, and it didn't matter if they were young or if they were old, it was the same sentiment the whole time, and I just thought that was such a kind of beautiful idea.
Ellie Levinson's new novel is Room 706. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. At macfound.org.
It is coming up on 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, and 10 o'clock, Jen Buey, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Most of northern Minnesota is still under an extreme cold warning, at least until noon today, perhaps Sunday at noon in northwestern Minnesota. And our temperatures today, 5 to 10 below for our highs, calm winds, lows tonight, 18 to 24 below, and tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 10 below to 1 above, and evening lows ranging from 19 to 24 below. Looking ahead to Monday, our temperatures in the low single digits above zero. Coming up tonight at 7, Christy Norland and Janet Bredeman, your volunteer hosts for Green Cheese Trivia. We continue with Weekend Edition.